This is Bill O'Brien. I'm here with Keith Lilly, and this is Prism West Virginia. This is our third chat in this series. It is the 21st day of March, the first full day of spring.
And
how are we doing, Keith?
And I'm thankful for that.
And so am I.
It's been a long winter.
It's been an unbelievable winter, but a good February, actually, and not a bad March. I mean, we really kind of lucked out. Welcome to the program. I hope that our teachers who are enrolled in the Prism One program are out there. Please take advantage of the sign behind us. We're not very classy. We're talking tonight about getting a banner that will have this look a little bit more professional. But for those of you out there who want to raise questions, who want to just send an email, just email Margaret Ramsey at mramsey@concord.edu, and Margaret will bring your questions into us. We'll get them on the air, and we'll address them as best we can. Also, if you are on the Ustream on the Head On Radio Network website, there is a built-in chat room in that session. You can type in your questions in the chat room. Bob Kincaid is sitting down there at the other end of this long table with access to the chat room, and he'll make us aware of any questions you type in that way. So, in a sense, you've got two opportunities, two ways to interact, raise questions, concerns, or whatever. I'm especially interested in this for our teachers, but also there are surely some folks out there who are not enrolled in the Prism West Virginia program for academic credit. This is a graduate course in American history run by Concord College, as many of you who've been with us before know. But we welcome all of those that are regular listeners and participants in the Head On Radio Network, in the Bob Kincaid program, and others. And we invite you to participate as well. If you have comments, if you have questions, if you would like clarification, I'm not guaranteeing that we can answer them, but we can sure bluff it a little bit.
Your
we
best.
Can give it a try. The most important thing this evening is that we get some basic information across. We address, as our teachers, our enrolled teachers know, our second assignment in this semester, in this course, the essay questions are due in a couple of weeks. I believe the 1st of April, if I'm not mistaken, is what the syllabus. And by all means, don't forget to go on Blackboard, look at the syllabus, not only the content. With the last chat we had, we spent an awful lot of time talking about the content, the historiography. We talked quite a bit about John Fisk and the critical period and that approach to the Confederation period. We contrasted it with the Internal Revolution thesis of Jensen. We talked about the different approaches and the different emphases. What we promised to do during this chat is to address the questions, the very specific questions that you have been asked. Hopefully, and I've got to take responsibility, good or bad, I made those questions up. And I hoped that those questions would encompass the major material that we're dealing with in this, the second unit of this course. I also had to hope that the reading required, that we've placed reading on your Kindles. I'll get to that. I've got a couple of things to say about the Kindles in a moment. But I want to make sure that the material that you need to address these questions is available in your readings, and that's very important as well. But what I would like to do this evening, besides addressing the questions themselves, and Keith and I can kind of bat back and forth how we would look at the questions, what we think the question is asking, what kinds of things a good answer ought to include, and then we'll leave it up to our teachers to go from there, knowing full well that if you are having problems or you are not sure of something or you have a question or a comment or a suggestion or whatever, by all means, please feel free to email us. You can email Margaret, mramsey@concord.edu, Keith Lilly at rklilly@concord.edu, or me, o'brien@concord.edu. We're all available. We will take your emails and get back to you, I promise. So by all means, don't hang out there and float around and not be sure of what you're doing. If you have questions or you're not sure of exactly which way you're going and what you're doing, remember, this is a graduate class for credit. What that means is, as you know, I hope I didn't mention this before because I assumed that everybody would know it, but you know what they say about assume. A graduate course, if you get anything below a B, it's an F for all practical purposes. So ultimately, we're looking for A's and B's out there, folks. And so what we mean is that, you know, don't just passing this is not going to work. If you are building a graduate transcript, everybody's going to be looking for A's and B's, and, you know, 4.0, 3.8, 3.5, something like that, over a whole graduate program, should these courses become part of a master's program of some sort. So I won't get into that now, but what I do want to say basically is it's very important that you do well. One other factor that I'd like to mention before we go into a couple of housekeeping things and a few other things, in terms of these questions, and Keith, I don't mean to rattle on here. Go ahead.
Well, there was one thing I did kind of want to interject, in a sense that this is always true, and as teachers, that they certainly know this. If one of them has a question, or one of them has some kind of need for clarification, in terms of one of these questions, I guarantee you several others
do
as well.
That too,
so
yeah.
That's almost always the case. And so you're not only doing yourself a favor by trying to get that clarification, you're probably also going to help others as well who probably have some of the same kinds of concerns.
And please don't be hung up with the idea that if you ask a question, we're going to think that you're ignorant or you don't know or whatever, and we're going to make some sort of value judgment on the quality of your work in the course or anything like that. I mean, we're not there. We are from the day we spent together a few weeks ago, here at the Irma Bird Center in Beckley. We are on a first-name basis. The purpose of this thing is together to make it through this and to come out at the other end with a little bit more appreciation of the founders and the content and all of that. But the thing I wanted to add before, because later on if I wait, I'll forget to mention this. Keep in mind two things. Keep in mind what we're asking you to do as teachers. And so the questions that you select to answer, the questions that you choose to answer, go where you think you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck in the classes that you teach. In other words, take the questions that address the issues and deal with the materials that you feel offer you real promise in terms of teaching your classes and meeting your objectives in the classes that you teach. That is absolutely vital. The other thing is, and I go back to Phil Roden's experience with the DBQ project. Keep in mind, you know, you are the teachers. But here, in this particular situation, you're being thrown into the role of student in this course. So in thinking about submitting these essays, think about the model for a good essay question that Phil Roden shared with us when he was with us all day Saturday a few weeks ago. In other words, think of the buckets. Think of the argument, the idea that not only is important to present the evidence, but you have to basically take the evidence and show how that evidence supports your answer to the question. In other words, we want, and that's what Phil was talking about, what you want your students to be able to do is take the appropriate information, put it in the appropriate buckets, and then address a bucket at a time. Basically, give your answer, which is your thesis statement, your opening paragraph or whatever. If you want to, if you want to do something that Phil referred to as the hook, by all means, do that. But what I'm looking for in these essays, first, that you address the question. Secondly, that you know the kinds of information that you need in order to support your answer to the question. And then thirdly, how you deal with this information and how you argue for your answer to the question. And then your conclusion is obviously a summation of the whole thing. In a nutshell, that's what we're talking about here.
And how they argue is more important than what they argue.
Than what they
right?
argue, right.
The conclusion is not really what we're focusing on. We're focusing on the process.
Phil Roden mentioned when he was there that day that one of the major missing elements when students take on essays, high school students and middle school students he's talking about, but even elementary students as well, if you give them a piece of an artifact, a painting or whatever, Washington crossing the Delaware or something like that, and ask them to give meaning to that picture. What do they see? What kinds of feelings do they get? What kinds of emotions does that picture generate in them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And what you're doing is collecting, putting together a lot. You're basically developing a lot of evidence. Then you basically formulate an overall interpretation of that artifact or that painting or that cartoon or that poem or that picture or whatever it is you're talking about. Then you go back and argue for your reading of that, your interpretation of that particular piece of Americana, piece of history, as it were. And basically what we're arguing for, what we're looking for, is your ability to take the information and show how it supports the answer to the question that you have chosen to offer. Phil mentioned that high school students and middle school students tend to eliminate the argue part. He told us that both times that he's been with us. And let me tell you, from years of grading essay exams at the college level, and I think Keith would agree with me, that even at the college level, what you see is that students will answer the question and then give you all the evidence that go into the answer, but they don't answer it. Mm. In other words, they don't analyze the information to show how the information supports their answer.
They just simply throw everything out there
and
they know.
And then it becomes the reader. In my case, if I'm grading it, it's up to me to take your evidence and apply it to your answer. And you want to do that. And that's kind of what I'm looking for. And so you want to do that. Your essay doesn't have to have everything. If there's something missing or something major that probably ought to be in there that isn't, I'll mention that. But you're not going to fail the essay because you leave something out. There's a mass of material here. In fact, I got all sorts of indications, directly and indirectly, in our day together a Saturday not too long ago about how much reading there is here, and I know that. What I'm basically saying is, you're not going to read this as if you're going to have to pass a test in it. Mm-hmm. What you're doing here is you got questions. Tonight, hopefully, by the time we get through, you'll have a fairly good handle on what the questions are asking you and what kinds of information you would want to address in order to answer that particular question. And then you can go where in your reading the material that you need to answer the question is located. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is developing answers to the question. But again, if you pick your questions well, you're going to be doing things that you can use in your teaching as well. You want to basically, wherever you can, incorporate as much primary source material as you can. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to give you a quiz on what Federalist 37 is about. You know, there's no way we're going to do that. But obviously, if you're arguing something that there's a whole Federalist paper devoted to, it might be a good idea to mention that if indeed you're aware of it. In other words, the obvious. And what we're trying to do is get you to think in this venue, because this is what ultimately we want and what Doris Williams wants to see evidence of, that this kind of thing is happening in our classes. And the result is going to be, I mean, there's no question in my mind that the result is going to be improved performance and improved understanding and appreciation of history and improved understanding and appreciation of the founders. A recognition that everything is not black and white, that they were confounded, they were torn, they were unsure, they were uncertain, they were frightened, they were...
Sometimes inconsistent.
Contradictory, one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, three steps back. I mean, they're human beings. And so what we want to do is try to, as much as we can, become much more familiar, as it were, with the period and the issues and the people, not the biographies. But on the other hand, there are an awful lot of good biographical stuff out there in Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Patrick Henry and all of these people. Those of you who did Patrick Henry's Give Me Death Street speech already know that Patrick Henry, I mean, if you have looked at Pauline Myers' book on ratification, there's this baby. I mean, it's a gem. If you've looked at this and you look at the chapters dealing with Virginia ratification, and you don't come away with an appreciation of Patrick Henry's oratorical power, even his arch enemy, Madison, basically says you can't do anything in Virginia without taking Patrick Henry into consideration. If he's not on your side and he's on the other side, you got to deal with the fact that you're going to have to deal with him. And he's tough. I mean, this is like March Madness gone crazy. In other words, it's trying to, what do you do to stop the superstar on the other team? I mean, we're into that this period. And that's what we're talking about. What do you do to stop somebody like Patrick Henry? And how do you deal with that? And that's what we're talking about, the appreciation for people. So there's a lot of places that you can go with elementary students in terms of the biographical stuff and the pictures and the speeches and excerpts of speeches and cartoons and all of these. I mean, it's just immense. What we want students to do is engage. And the irony of the situation is that while we have to face the reality that elementary students don't have the content background that middle and secondary students do. We appreciate that. We understand that. The teachers understand that. The fact of the matter is, what elementary kids have that unfortunately, a lot of middle and high school students don't have is interest and enthusiasm.
We found this out this past weekend. Yeah.
Keith and I both judged a social science fair here in Beckley on Saturday. And it was really interesting because we had three divisions, three categories. The first category, Division 1, was 4th and 5th graders. Division 2 was middle school.
Division 3 was high school.
Fact of the matter is, almost all the no-shows were at the high school level. The quality of the displays, of the projects, deteriorated as the kids got older because the interest wasn't there. I hope I don't give away the secret because I don't know the little girl's name. But one of the projects that I judged in Division 1 was the history of the Toll House cookie. And that little girl who told me about Toll House cookies and about the woman Wakefield in Massachusetts who turned her Toll House into a place where she's the one that baked chocolate chip cookies. And I asked her, I said, a question's been driving me crazy all my life. Are Toll House cookies and chocolate chip cookies the same thing? And she looked at me and she kind of winked at me and said, I think so. And she was about 8, and I just absolutely melted. I've been dreaming since Saturday about that little girl. She is the cutest thing, and I thought to myself, if you can't get her interested in the founders and in history, you can't get anybody. This child is just, and the others were the same. The point I'm trying to make is that while the level of sophistication at the elementary school level is going to be substantially less, the procedure and the process and what we ask them to do, elementary teachers have something going for them that middle and high school teachers don't, and that's interest and enthusiasm. You don't have to motivate, you don't have to manipulate your students into being interested in something that maybe they're not. These kids are interested in.
And I think something that Phil Roden was able to do is able to show us, not just here recently, but also this past summer, is with his program, he really makes a great effort to kind of develop or find the types of sources that are appropriate for the right age levels.
Right.
And I know from my own experience, sometimes having students, even college students, look at a source that's visual, mm-hmm. a painting or something of that nature, often can take you in different avenues and can produce in some students more enthusiasm than other types of primary sources. And we shouldn't get into the mindset that the only primary sources are written documents, because that's certainly not the case. Primary sources are anything contemporary with the event being studied.
That's right.
And as the grant moves on, and we move past into the 19th century, and it obviously starts thinking about foreign policy and other issues we'll deal with, we'll be able to use all kinds of different types of primary sources.
And so
you can't limit yourself.
And that's why, two things. I know I mentioned this before, and I don't like to do this. Everybody says historians is just repeat. But I don't mean to do that. But remember that the West Virginia Encyclopedia, the PRISM portion of this program, the West Virginia sources, the Appalachian sources, you've got two places to go. One is you can go on Bob Kincaid's website, headonradionetwork.com. Look at the archives. And in there, you've got Jeff Bigger's presentation from last summer. And he gave us some names and some sources that we can go to for the Appalachian connection that we can make with our youngsters. That's the first thing to keep in mind. The other thing is that beginning this year, the West Virginia Encyclopedia that every one of you was given a hard copy of is now available free online in e-version, which means that you can extract and print key sections, biographical information on people, or excerpts on particular events or whatever you want to do to build in the West Virginia connection, the prison part of this whole process. So there's an awful lot of information at your fingertips, as it were, that I think that you can use.
I'll also point out the Lewis and Hennin collection of documents that I talked about this past summer, and I believe I put a link on prison on the web page on the blackboard to that collection of documents. They're all primary sources. They're grouped by time period, right. And so they all deal with this part of the country, with right. Western Virginia and the Western Virginia frontier.
Right.
Some of them may well be relevant as well.
Just remember, you are not research historians. We are not expecting, you know, unbelievable things in terms of resources. What I mean is, don't worry about not knowing about a document. I don't know documents, and this is my area. And there's a lot of documents that I don't know. I'm still in the wow stage of my life. You know, and what I mean is, you continue to learn. This stuff continues to grow. But if you run across a primary document or primary source that seems to fit in to what you want to say about one of these questions, once you understand the question itself and what it's asking you and the framework within which we're asking you to operate, then it seems to me you just do a quick survey of some of the anti-federalist documents and some of the Federalist speeches, and look at a copy of the Federalist Papers, and in the table of contents, it's going to tell you what the theme is: representation, right. Representation, the presidency, the Senate, the House of Representatives, the court, taxing, supremacy clause, the Constitution and the laws made under it will be the supreme law of the land. You know, supreme law of the land, the so-called supremacy clause, the contract clause. I mean, all of these things. And so, if that's a big part of what you want to say, then use that as your theme as you go through. Use the index in the back of the book. It'll tell you where some of this stuff
is. Use the bibliography in the notes.
Bibliography at the end. Yeah. And, you know,
a good secondary source will always lead you to primary sources.
Right.
So,
because
and those are good secondary sources.
A good secondary source has good footnotes, and that'll tell you exactly where the person who wrote the book went to get his or her information. So again, you know, be creative. This is a creative thing. This is not science. This is art.
Yeah.
And basically, as teachers of youngsters, knowing how important it is, your role as an artist is critical. You've got to get these kids interested in this thing, because more and more, the article was in the paper West Virginia getting a D in American history. And it's just more evidence of what our challenge is. Let me take a moment before we get into the questions themselves to address one or two things. One is, I want to briefly go through the summer program, what we're looking at in terms of dates, when you report, those kinds of things, because Margaret's gotten some emails. People are asking these questions just to confirm, because I know, like me, you're trying to plan your vacations during summer and all that. So you need to have some pretty specific information. And I'm prepared to give you some of that here this evening. The other thing is the issue of the libraries. And I don't want to overplay this or belabor this. But it's very important, because we allocated $12,500 a year to go to our local libraries to work with us in these projects. Now, remember, the purpose of that money is not specifically to buy information or buy materials or buy books or buy tapes or buy licenses or buy subscriptions or whatever. That's not what we're about. The purpose of this was to forge closer relationships, closer links between you, the teacher, and your students and the libraries. And hopefully, I mean, this, you know, there's a little bit of self-interest in this too. Hopefully, to forge closer relationships between your local libraries and Concord's Marsh Library, which is critical here. This morning, I sat in Steve Rao's office in the library, and he got on his computer, and he dialed into the Rotunda website for the first time. It's available on campus. It's not available to you yet. Now, what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to basically create a link under the library. So if you go to Concord's website, www.concord.edu, and you basically go to the library, then one of the links under the library is going to be Rotunda. Excuse me. And when that appears. You'll be able to click on Rotunda, and there'll be an IP number there, and you will be able to go directly into the Rotunda sources. Steve Rao today on his desk was into the Abigail Adams papers at his desk today because the Rotunda is finally up. It's finally available. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's got to know every letter and every artifact and every document that's in the Rotunda collection. That's not the point. But anything you want to know about the founders is there. And so, you know, if you run across particular reference in one of these books, one of these secondary sources, to a particular speech given on a specific day, or to a letter from Madison to Jefferson or Washington to Madison or something like that, and you have the date, you can go to Rotunda and get the whole letter.
And I think Meyer especially made use of that collection to a large degree, so that would certainly be the case in terms of the Meyer book. Are they going to have to have... Are they going to have to log in like they do to Blackboard in order to get into the collection?
Well, as far as I know, because they already have Concord accounts, emails.
Yeah, they can use that.
Directly access.
They can use that just like
so. You'll need your account, you know, your password, and your ID
Your
ID
and prefix to your
and then your password. Yeah. It's the prefix to your email address.
Yeah, like mine is RK Lilly. Yours is O'Brien.
And I just type in there, and then I dial my password, and I'm in. And then you just click on, you go to library, and then click on Rotunda, and it'll be there. It's not there as of today, but it should be there, very honestly, by the end of the week for sure.
Okay.
So, you know, I wanted to mention that. But back to the issue of the library. We allocated $13,000 a year to these projects in local libraries. And as I mentioned, I spoke to the Mountain Library Network board meeting in the fall. I drove up to, I can't remember, Davis and Elkins or somewhere. I can't remember where I went, Buchanan or somewhere. And spoke to the folks at the board, and I told the librarians that they would be hearing from you, the teachers. And what I mentioned is that if you work with your local library and you define needs that will help you with this project, with the PRISM project, that if you put together a paragraph as to what it is you want in your local library and why you want it and what the cost is and all of that, we'll evaluate them if we get too many. But since we are able to fund five $2,500 projects a year, we're able to do five. And theoretically, we're good for 5 years. That allows us to fund 25 projects. Now, that means we'll go back to some libraries for a second and maybe even a third time. That doesn't matter. The point I'm trying to make is that we had no takers for the first year money. So in order that we wouldn't lose it, what we did is we picked six libraries strategically located throughout our service area in southern West Virginia, and we sent them a letter, and we say, we're basically allocating $2,500 for this project to your library. And what that means is, then we said, we're alerting you, the teachers, that the money's there. So that all you need to do is make contact with one of these local libraries that has the money, and then you can do that. Well, we've had a couple of takers. Raleigh County Library has used theirs, and I believe Summers County, I heard today, had bought a lot of material, a lot of books primarily for theirs. Starting this summer, we're going to have more than 50 new teachers coming on board. The same program is available to those teachers. So if something you want is available, you need to strike before we get 50 more teachers who are after that money. The other thing to keep in mind is this program, this course on the founders, is only the first of five courses. All five of these courses are part of this project. So if there's something on the Civil War or something on contemporary America or something on labor history or something on women's history or something on foreign policy or something on the Supreme Court, whatever it is that you might want that relates to the ideals and the values of the founders, and you want to work out with your local library, we'll fund it. We want you to use that money. The money is not out there to make you jump through hoops for it. The money's out there so you will get it. We want to give it away. We don't want it left. So the reason I mention this is Steve Rao sent me an email last week, at the end of last week, and said that the Mountain Library Network Library Board had met. And one of the issues on their agenda, according to the minutes, was the PRISM project. And the librarians were claiming, first of all, that they didn't know who the teachers in their area were that were involved in the project, and that they were waiting for somebody to come forward from the project to help them get this money, but nobody, they hadn't heard from anybody. So I'm not saying go out there and just come up, don't just create something to use the money. You don't want to do that. But if there is something that you would like to do, by all means do it. Because starting in July, after we finish our summer project, our summer on-campus experience, we'll have an additional 55 teachers. Right now it's 55 teachers that we've got, new ones.
So it could become with that money too. It could come become very competitive.
It could become very competitive. So if you can think of something that you might want or need, go to your local library, find out what they have, tell them about the project, find out what they have or what they might like to have that would help you and your students, and order it before anybody else gets in on it.
I think what you find very often in local libraries, county libraries, for example, right here in Raleigh County, the Raleigh County Library is actually very strong when it comes to history, both American and European, especially for a library its size. I think they've done an exceptional job.
Well, I'll tell you.
But what they don't have very often, what you don't find in local libraries, are document collections.
Document collections. And that's
primary source-based
things. The Rotunda stuff is just incredible. Yeah. All John Kaminsky's ratification stuff is on there. But the other thing I was going to say is that the Raleigh County Library is particularly strong in the Civil War. And that's
yes, it is.
And that's because of Darryl.
Yes, it is. Darryl, it's very strong.
Darryl, yeah. the research librarian there, is a fanatic, is the word I use.
Some of them are especially strong in certain areas of Civil War history.
Right.
Numerous biographies of particular generals, I guess you might say.
So, again, if don't hesitate to contact Steve Rao. If you're playing around with an idea but you can't really get your arms around it, you can't define it, maybe he can help you. But again, we want you to use this money. We held over a lot of it from the first year. But be aware that we're more than halfway through our second year of funding right now. This fiscal year, the second one, ends June 30th. And after June 30th, as of July 1st, we'll be into our third year of federal funding. And we haven't done a whole lot to spend years one and two yet. So it's very, very important. Now, I'll try to hold this money over as long as the federal government will allow me to do it.
I'd really encourage everyone to maybe look at googlebooks.com or look at amazon.com and see what's in print. And maybe even look at some of the university press sites and see really what is in print. You might be able to determine what kind of, maybe especially if you're thinking about document collection, a collection of letters, a volume that has particular letters or something in it, that might give you an idea about what you might really want to go for in terms of this.
Right.
Just finding out what's in print. And so in order to do that, you really kind of have to go beyond the history book club selections or something of that nature. That's all going to be secondary stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm assuming that they certainly can use these funds in order to get good, sound secondary sources, biographies, things like that, that people outside of the whole project will actually be able to read and glean something from. But if you can find something that would be especially useful to you, chances are it's going to be useful to your students, right? So that's certainly advantageous.
One of the things that Steve Rao, the librarian, is going to do this summer with all of us when we get together is he's got the hard collections of Harper's Magazine, all of them from the 1850s and 60s. And he's going to basically take, I think it's a 12-year period he's talking about, and he's going to put all the magazines on a cart and wheel them up to the classroom that we're in. And basically he's going to go through the magazines, and we're going to look at the Civil War as it was written about month by month by month as Harper Magazine dealt with the Civil War. In other words, he's going to basically take us through this primary source material month by month as Harper's wrote its own ongoing history of the Civil War.
And all the political cartoons. The Thomas Nast cartoons. Yeah.
We're going to see it all. Yeah. So I can't wait for that. And that reminds me of one more thing is that we're going to be putting together the agenda for the summer program very, very quickly. It's just a matter of trying to do this course and get the syllabus together. If you looked at that syllabus, it took me probably longer than I didn't realize that the last third of my life was going to be spent writing that syllabus. But I apologize for that, but I kind of literally got into it a little bit. But we'll be doing the agenda. But let me, while we're on that, let me give you the dates again. Because most of you out there, the teachers who have been with us, who are the veterans, so to speak, you've been with us throughout the whole year. First of all, our summer program is going to begin early in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, 8:30, I believe, on Wednesday, June 29th. But not for you. This is going to be for our new teachers. Our new teachers are going to report on Wednesday, June 29th. And we're going to have them all day Wednesday and all day Thursday, and maybe a portion of Friday, depending on whether Tom Tierney is going to be with us or not. I'm waiting on final confirmation from him. If he can be with us, we're going to give him Friday morning.
And everybody needs to keep their fingers crossed there. Because if he doesn't show, then I'm doing Hobbs and you're doing Locke.
Right, and that's going to be nice.
And that's not going to quite
disaster.
Be as that's not going to be what it should be.
Yeah. So, there's Locke and Hobbs and there's Hawk and Loves. So, anyway, so the first Friday is iffy at this point, but it only affects the new teachers because the first half, the first 4 days or 4.5 days of our summer academy are going to be the founding. We're going to try to compress what we did this past summer into the 4 days for the new teachers. So they're going to be doing the founding on Wednesday the June 29th, Thursday the 30th, and perhaps, depending on whether Tom Tierney is available, Friday morning, July 1st. And then we'll have the weekend, and the next Monday is the 4th of July, so we will not meet the 4th of July. But we will. The new teachers will reconvene on Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock, 8:30, and we will have Tuesday and Wednesday on the founding. That will complete the founding. John Kaminsky is going to be with us on Tuesday and Wednesday. If any of you would like to come back to spend the day with John Kaminsky or revisit John's presentation or whatever, you're more than welcome to do that. You don't have to do it because you've been through it once. But if you'd like to come back and see John or talk to John or share with him some of your experiences or whatever, I know that he'd love it. I know Tom Tierney would love it. The piece that we're going to have this summer that we didn't have last summer because of his illness is Bob Bliss. Yeah. Bob Bliss has already asked me the specific dates, and I've got confirmation. He will be with us on Wednesday and Thursday, the 29th and 30th of June, for the new teachers. But if you would like to come, you are more than welcome. You do not have to.
One thing we could do is we could put the agenda on Blackboard.
Well,
and that way,
we'll have the agenda on Blackboard. We'll mail you hard copies of the agenda, and the programs will be on HeadOnRadioNetwork.com live. So you'll be able to get them that way. But if you'd like to come and join us and talk with these folks, by all means, you're free to do that. So you, the veteran teachers, will not report until Thursday, July 6th. That's the second week. So we will have been through one Thursday. The second Thursday will be when we begin the 19th century. And that's when the founding will end, and then we will begin the 19th century, and we will have Thursday and Friday, because we're doing 4 days that week since we don't have Monday. And then the next week, the last week, we'll have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday on the 19th century, and Friday portion of it if we need it. You know, I don't really know what we're doing at this point. But we will put together an agenda that spells out those dates. So you veterans do not have to report until Thursday, July 6th. If you would like to come to the week before that or the few days before that to see John Kaminsky earlier that week, by all means, you're more than welcome to do it. We'll feed you. We'll put you up at the dorms if you want that. You know, the last thing I want to do is deny you access to what I think is an absolute treasure, historical treasure. So anyway, those are the dates, and we'll be getting specific information out on that. Also, I'll be putting the third unit of this class on Blackboard as quickly as I can. It's not going to be nearly, believe me, as extensive as the first two units. It's going to deal with the Washington and Adams administration, the quasi-war with France, Jefferson's election of 1800 as a revolution, the movement towards renewed war with Great Britain, and ultimately what becomes the War of 1812. And that will be the end. And what, again, our theme is going to be the implementation of the ideas of the founders and the values and all the things we've looked at so far. So there is a theme throughout all of this. So the third unit will not be nearly as extensive or comprehensive as the first two. The due date, we will have to get this done by the first week in May. So your last set of essays will have to be due early in May, because I'm going to have to turn grades in at the end of the semester along with everybody else at Concord. Most of you now, we've gotten some emails on this. I had to give everybody an incomplete at the end of the fall semester because this course was not complete. It was a whole year course. So that meant that everybody got an incomplete because the course was only partially completed in December. But everybody will get a grade in May, early in May, when I submit the final grades. I was telling Keith, I have not read yet, I will, but I have your first essays all printed out, all stapled together. I'm going to be reading these and reacting individually to each of you by email on the first essay. So as you're working on this second essay, I'll be sending you comments on your first essay. So I'm not going to do anything elaborate. I don't want it to take too long. I want it to be helpful. I want it to be positive. Remember what Phil Roden said. If an exam is going to be a learning experience, then I owe you, as the person who wrote these essays, I owe you comments and kudos for what you did well. And I need to say, from my perspective, you could strengthen your essay if you had gone there, if you had considered this or whatever. But that's what I'm going to do. There's no way in the world I'm going to say, you know, you are not worthy to be a member of the human race based on your response. I'm not going to do that. That's not what this is about.
Right.
You are teachers and you are professionals, and you've got the future of this country in your hands, literally. And we want to do everything that we can do to make you do that well, and that's what all this is about. So please keep that in mind. Anything else?
Well, I do want to remind everybody about the field trip. And we've talked about that, I think, the last chat. We certainly talked about it when the teachers were here. But we're going to have the field trip with Dave Bard.
On the 8th. Friday the 8th,
right,
of July.
And we are going to have a military history section, a presentation.
Is it the 8th or the
7th? It's the 8th. It's the 8th, okay. Friday the 8th. We're going to do Droop Mountain and Lewisburg.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to try to do it all in one day.
Right.
Since there was also a battle at Lewisburg.
We'll have buses, and we'll feed you and everything.
And entertain you as
and
well.
Many right? of you know Dave Bard, and you've been on
field trips. You'll certainly
Dave
be
Bard,
entertained.
So,
yeah.
So you know what you're in for more than I do. I've never experienced this before, so I've heard a lot about it. So we'll be doing that on July 8th. So that's one change that we'll have this summer that we didn't have last summer. So I think it's going to be great. We're going to do the best we can to make this a memorable experience. But again, how it plays out in your classes with your students is the ultimate test, and whether in fact this has been a worthwhile exercise or not. Again, let me remind you, before we get into these questions, and you might have comments or suggestions or criticisms or questions or whatever, if you email Margaret, she's sitting at a computer right now watching us, and if you email her at mramsey@concord.edu, and just jot your question down. She'll print it out and bring it in. We'll read the question here. Keith or I will read the question, and we'll do the best we can to respond to it. Keith, are we ready to get into the questions?
Yeah, I think so. I'll tell you what, let's start with the first one. Start right at the top. I'm going to read the question, and I think you're going to react to it, and we're going to see where we go with it from there.
Now remember, our goal is not to answer that. We're not telling you what to write. This is your essay.
Right.
But basically, what I want you to know after we get through tonight is what each question is asking you and what we think you probably ought to think about and consider and address in order to answer the particular question.
Okay. The first question starts with a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson in the early 19th century, and it's from Gordon Wood's book Radicalism, which I think you have a copy of there, Radicalism and the American Revolution.
Yeah, I'm going to...
There you
say a
go.
Couple of things about this after he reads the question.
Okay, so this is where that quote is from, and this is Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I quote, "It is the age of severance, of disassociation, of freedom, of analysis, of detachment, every man for himself. The social sentiments are weak. The sentiment of patriotism is weak. Veneration is low. The natural affections feebler than they were. People grow philosophical about native land and parents and relations." And, of course, you have in brackets here the revolution and the democracy that resulted from it. It had destroyed all the ties and ligaments of the old society. And this quote is from Ralph Waldo Emerson, the early 19th century. It sums up pretty well the differences between the republicanism that revolutionary leaders had wanted in 1776 and what America ended up with by the time Emerson wrote about it. Indeed, Wood even writes that, and I quote, All the major revolutionary leaders died less than happy with the results of the revolution. So here's the question. Can you address this issue by contrasting your sense of what republicanism was in 1776 and what it seemed to become with efforts to implement it during the Confederation? Do you see evidences, hence, in the 1780s of the problems that would concern Emerson so many years later? Any thoughts about ways that Americans tried to cope with these challenges? And, of course, there's a note here. Don't overlook the issues and sources John Kaminsky provides here in his Federalist and Anti-Federalist. His chapter one, his first chapter, is on republicanism.
Okay, I mentioned to react to this question first, we want to basically make sure that everybody's aware of what the question is asking. I also want to do some clarification about Gordon Wood's book, Radicalism of the American Revolution. I went on Amazon before we got the Kindles. And on Amazon, it clearly says that this book, Radicalism of the American Revolution, is available on Kindle. So I fully intended that when you received your Kindle, this book would be on it. After the fact, after all the Kindles were loaded, I realized that this book is not going to be available on Kindle until this August. So you don't have this on your Kindles. Do the best you can if you want to take this question. I think this is the best. I really do like this question. And if this is a question that you feel comfortable about and you'd like to take on and you feel would get the interests of your students, then by all means take it. Don't be afraid that I'm going to take off points by holding this book up to you when, in fact, you don't have it. That would be a little bit ridiculous. Consistent sometimes with what we do in education, but ridiculous. So I'm not going to do that. If this is a question that you would like to take on, and I think it's a very worthwhile question, and we'll go into the reasons why in a second, then by all means, feel free to do it. If you want to buy, this is reduced. It's like $10 if you get a hard copy of this on Amazon. I mean, it's a reduced rate. I think it may be like $12.94 or $12.79, something like that. But it's not going to be available on Kindle until August. We will make sure that our new teachers have it for next year's course in the founding. But you don't have it. And I just want you to be aware of that. So therefore, what I thought I might do this evening is kind of give you a little bit more information about what's in this book than I ordinarily would if you had the book. And basically what I said is I'm going to kind of tell you a few things that are in this book, and then if you choose to take this question and you want to use those, you can. Okay, because I think the question is extremely relevant. Keith, do you remember at the beginning of the course, in the first unit, the first syllabus, the first portion, the unit one portion of the syllabus that we put together, there were some quotes in there from Hamilton and Jefferson and Madison, et cetera, on republicanism and what a republic is and all that stuff, if you remember. And I know all of you have that. It's on Blackboard. There was a quote in there from Jefferson. And what Jefferson was talking about, and I can't remember that. I didn't take, time to look it up this evening. But if you look back through Unit 1 syllabus, you'll find this quote from Jefferson. And it's based on the idea that the founders believed, Jefferson believed, that the very essence of human nature meant that people naturally cared about other people. Remember the argument that, you know, this idea, and it goes all the way back, I'm not writing your essay for you here, but if you go all the way back in Western civilization to Christianity, to the origins of Christianity, and the idea that Adam and Eve and man's fall and the Puritan belief that man was basically evil, because, you know, that man's nature was basically
original
corrupt.
Sin, yeah.
And the idea of original sin, man was stained forever with original sin because of Adam's sin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's this basic idea in Western civilization that man cannot do what's right unless he's forced to.
Depraved.
Yeah. That man, if left free to do what he chooses to do, will do evil. Because basically human nature is evil. And Cotton Mather in Puritan Massachusetts used to talk about students, young students in school. And he said basically they come to us and they're empty vessels. And it's very important that we fill those vessels with truth. Because if we don't, they're going to be filled with untruth.
Yeah, the devil will fill them with
the
untruth.
The devil will fill them with untruth. So it's very important that we fill them before the devil has a chance to fill them. And the idea is that given people's absolute freedom to do what they want, they will always choose evil over good. They will always choose wrong over right. So then the question becomes, given that, how could the founders in 1776, how could they be so naive and so idealistic and so pie in the sky to believe that man would naturally care about his fellow man, that man would naturally worry about his brother? How could we expect people to be willing voluntarily to put the best interests of everybody ahead of their own self-interest, ahead of their own greed and private interest? In other words, the founders believed that republicanism, absolutely going all the way back to classical Greece and Rome, they believed that the essence of republican government was the virtue of the citizens. Citizens' willingness to put the public good ahead of their own private self-interest and the private good. And the idea that people would naturally do this. And the basic point I'm making is that Western civilization taught that man is naturally evil, and he's not going to do it unless you force him to do it.
Right.
And that became a rationalization for despotism and autocratic government. And the idea the only way that people will do what's right is if they're forced to do it or they're tricked into doing it.
Right, and of course, I mean, you take us back to St. Paul, St. Augustine, certainly it's so. But even if you look at, like, Thomas Hobbes, we mentioned him a while ago, Thomas Hobbes justified absolutism, the rule of the king.
The need for absolute government.
In other words,
so correct.
Yeah, if we do not, in a state of nature, without civil society, without civil government, what we will be is a wolf to our fellow man.
Right.
Life will be solitary, nasty, poor, brutish, and short.
Tom Tilly last year.
Exactly.
And you know, the state of nature is a state of war where every man is at war with every other man.
War of all against all.
If everybody's free, then there's anarchy.
Yeah.
There is not order. And so Hobbes's argument was the only way to create order out of this chaos is to create an absolutely all-powerful government and not give people any rights or any freedoms of their own.
Because you surrender your rights,
right.
Yeah.
And the argument is, if you create a government which is strong enough and powerful enough to create peace, then you can have a little bit of freedom because government's protecting the environment. So your freedom is a direct relationship to the success and the power of government. The more powerful and effective government is, the freer you are. The less powerful government is, the more we're moving towards anarchy, and your freedom becomes more and more at risk.
Maybe something is helpful here. Hopefully I'm not throwing you or anyone else off.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking about Hobbes, what Hobbes is suggesting, and really what divine right suggests in terms of, you know, absolute monarchy, that suggests a society in which your goal is stability. Your goal is static. Your goal is not progress. Because, and that is the fundamental difference, in turn, the fundamental change in Western civilization that takes place, during the Enlightenment, in which you break with that old idea of no progress.
This is where we're going with this question.
Yeah, I figured it. I was hoping that was the case.
And, okay, so that's the Hobbes and Locke thing. We won't go into the details, but you can go back and check with Tom Tierney, his presentation on the Ustream archive. And you can find that. Okay. So the bottom line is we go to Emerson's quote. And Emerson's writing from the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically saying, you know, and I'm basically paraphrasing here because I don't want to reread the whole thing. But basically what Emerson's saying is everything that the founders believed in 1776 has turned out to be a myth, has turned out to be not true. They were naive. They were too idealistic. They realized very quickly that man could not overcome his evil nature, that civic virtue wasn't there unless government consciously forced it to be there and cultivated and rewarded and punished you if it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
you know, in other words, moving more towards sort of a Hobbesian kind of look at kind of way of looking at society. And Emerson, in his quote, this is the age of severance, of disassociation, of freedom, analysis, detachment. It's every man for himself. Social sentiments are weak. There's no patriotism. There's no willingness to put the public good ahead of your own private good. So very, very quickly, the founders learn that the idealism of 1776 was just that, idealism. Okay, now, Gordon Wood's book on radicalism. This is a Pulitzer Prize winner. When you read it, you'll know why. It's an absolutely, I think it's a stupendous book in so many ways. This book is divided, I mentioned this before, but I'm repeating myself, I know. This book is divided into three sections. The first unit, if you wanted to call it unit rather than chapter, the first unit, I'm struggling, the first unit is on monarchy. The second unit is on republicanism. And the third unit is on democracy. And then under each unit, he has five or six chapters. Okay. What he does, and I'm summarizing here because many of you don't have the book unless you've bought it or you want it. It's well worth it if you want to purchase it. By all means, it's available everywhere. It's a Pulitzer Prize winner, so it's not hard to get. But in his chapters on hierarchy, patricians and plebeians, patriarchal dependence, patronage, and political authority, what Gordon Wood is describing is the colonial image of what a traditional, stable, well-organized, orderly society ought to be like. What the way, in other words, the way society ought to be. This is the discussion of the assumptions which go into the idealism of the founders. In other words, the founders believe that societies were naturally this, that people naturally deferred to their betters, that people naturally held back their own opinions in favor of getting opinions from those who knew more, who were better, who were more worldly, who were better read, who were more widely traveled, who came from families of image and prestige and positions, whose children had studied in Europe, those who were familiar with classical music and the arts and literature and poetry and had read Shakespeare and on and on and on, and Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey, and had a quality liberal arts education. The belief was, if you read this, the belief was that a liberal arts education was the way you could distinguish the educated from the not educated. And so the assumption was that this society would naturally happen and that people would naturally defer to their betters and defer to the judgment of their betters and that they would look to their betters to hold the positions of power in government, political officers, governors and members of the colonial assemblies and all the rest of it, that the decisions that mattered for society as a whole would be made by the people most qualified to make them. The assumption was that these were the people who could afford to put the best interest, the public interest, ahead of their own private interest. They were already rich. They didn't need any more. So the assumption is they can be honest. I don't know how to put this, but you all live in America today. You know what I'm talking about. Basically, what we're saying is that people who already have it made, the Donald Trumps, for example, who's considering a run for president, whatever you may think of Donald Trump, whether you want to be fired by him or hired by him, the fact of the matter is he's so damn rich that he ain't going to cheat us. He's already got all he can spend, you know. So basically, this is the basic idea, the basic rationale.
And is the idea there that they have, in essence, a stake in society?
Yeah.
Which is really kind of where property qualifications
right.
come from. So let's say in Virginia, the idea is the planters should govern. The planters should be the ones who make decisions. They have the leisure. They have the stake in society.
Right. They have the most to lose.
Yes, they have the most to lose.
So therefore, right. they have a vested interest in doing what's right so that their best interests will be taken care of. And the assumption is if their best interests are being taken care of, then so are yours. Mm-hmm. Because you've got so much less than they have. Yeah. So in pursuing, this is the irony, nowhere does Gordon Wood say this in his book. This is me talking. But the irony of ironies here is that these people believed that if you turn power over to the well-to-do, their private interest would be the public interest. In other words, if the people who had the most to lose and the most to lose if things went wrong and the most to gain if things were right, and if society remains stable, turn power over to them, let them make decisions, and their decisions in their own interests automatically become our interest. That is the public interest. And that's what these people believe. That was the naivete of the founders. So when they begin to implement the elements of republicanism, which is Unit 2, the republicanization of monarchy, and what he's basically saying is, how do you take these ideas of a monarchical society where the best people run things? It's a top-down system. How do you take it and how do you fuse this with the ideas of republicanism? How do you bring the two together? And that's what he's talking about, the republicanization of monarchy. A truncated society, loosening the bands of society, enlightened paternalism, revolution, the Enlightenment, benevolence. In other words, how do you get people to practice Christian charity? How do you basically make certain that people are willing to take care of the poor and to help out those that aren't making it, realizing that all of us benefit from this if nobody's starving. If people become desperate and people are starving and they're losing their homes and and their kids are starving and all the rest of it, they'll steal and kill. You will have anarchy. So ultimately, everybody has a vested interest in a stable society where people care about each other, are genuinely concerned about each other, and are willing to basically look out for the best interests of each other. People who are willing to put the best interests of the public as a whole ahead of their own self-interests. Because basically, the assumption is that if I basically put my self-interest first, it's going to be whatever's good for me, the hell with you. And the argument is you can't let that kind of a person in a position of influence. You got to make sure that your offices are staffed by people who've already made it, who have nothing personal to gain. What they want is they preach benevolence, and they teach humanity, and they teach brotherhood, and they teach Christian charity, and they basically practice it. And the assumption is they don't look for salaries for office holding. They don't want to get paid. The assumption is because of their position in society, this is the way they give back. That it is expected that your success in society involves the fact that you'll be willing to give back a portion of that to your community, to the people in your society.
That's a very classical concept.
Yeah.
I mean, it really goes back to Greece, right. With the whole idea of civic virtue in terms of, I mean, Athens for a long time did not pay government officials. And then eventually, once you get into the period of Pericles, right. They did. And that's often portrayed, especially as the beginning of the end for them. And that's the reason why Sparta prevailed,
right.
And Athens failed.
And because the belief is, and Gordon Wood has quotes in this in the book. I'll get to this in a second. But the argument is that if you pay office holders, then you're going to get people who run for office because they need the money or they want the money. Mm-hmm. And so their self-interest is what causes them to be a candidate, not their willingness or their commitment to public service. And so going into today's society with our politicians today, the Tea Party, for example, what we're seeing with the Tea Party today, the idea being that what we want are people that are willing to serve because they want to give back and they want to do their bit. We don't want permanent office holders. We want rotation in office. We want term limits so that people can't hold office for so long that they feel that that job is their private property. But the fear of the founders was that if you pay the office holders, then you're going to get the wrong kind of people standing for office. You're going to elect the wrong kind of people. That you're going to have the people who ought to be holding these offices running against the people who are after it because of the money it pays.
Who will ruthlessly pursue it?
Yeah, I'm not greedy necessarily.
Right.
But I thought a few years ago, in 2002. My wife was on city council here in Beckley, and she died in December. And her term didn't end until the following July. And the mayor, God love him, out of the graciousness of his heart, asked me and got the council to approve if I would fill out the last 6 months of Joan's term on city council. I did. I loved it. Yeah, to me, it was. I absolutely found it not only fascinating, but I ended up having a lot of respect for this council and mayor and all that. So we won't get into that. But the bottom line is, as I move closer to retirement, one of the considerations I had, my wife has said to me, is why don't you think about maybe retiring, running, from Concord, and running for city council. You know, and this community's given a lot to you, and you can give back. Besides, city council pays like $250 a month. You get a check every month for $250. And you're in retirement. You're living on Social Security. $250 a month would be a nice income. I mean, you could make a car payment, a good piece of a car payment on that. And so the founders would say, we don't want you if you're in it for $250. We don't want you, you know. And so basically that's the idea. So what you begin to get is you begin to get a contradiction. I'm holding up to the camera here. You begin to have a contradiction between the ideals of a monarchical society and the realities of republicanism trying to make the two fit. You run into all these contradictions. And so the reality is that very quickly it emerges to the founders that what we thought was going to happen automatically ain't going to happen. And we're going to have to figure out a way to make it happen. We're going to have to figure out a way to create public virtue or civic virtue and make people we're going to have to reward virtue. We're going to have to punish behavior that is not virtuous, you know, and these kinds of things. And so ultimately, what you begin to find is the ideals of republicanism tend to conflict with the realities of independence. And the ideal republican society that the founders thought would naturally evolve after the Declaration of Independence, quickly, it becomes clear to many of the founders that it ain't going to happen, and we're going to have to do something fast, because what we thought was going to happen is not happening, and this society is going down the tube, and that's the John Fisk approach, the critical period in the Confederation period. And then the third section of Gordon Wood's book is democracy, and this is the reality of what we end up with by the time we get into Jefferson's administration, and especially as we move towards Andrew Jackson in the late 1820s, and that's when Emerson writes. And when Emerson writes, his quote in the 1830s is, look at our society, it's gone to hell, is what Emerson, he's not saying that, I'm saying that. But what Emerson is saying, he said much better than me, I say go to hell, but he puts it in a way which he can get away with. We have dissociation, freedom, analysis, detachment. It's every man for himself. Social sentiments are weak. The sentiment of patriotism is weak. Veneration is low. Natural affections, feebler than they were. People don't care about each other like we thought they would. People only care about themselves and about their own self-interest. They're looking to help their own kids before they help other people's kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How can we create the society? And that's why Emerson says in italics, all the major revolutionary leaders died less than happy with the results of the revolution. What they dreamed would happen didn't happen. Now,
I can't.
I don't want to go all and spend the whole time just on this question. Let me alert you to a couple of quick things here, and I want to show you what I mean, and you can look this up in the library if you get the book and Xerox this page. On page 290 and 291. There's a story here from the Constitutional Convention with Benjamin Franklin. Gordon Wood says, one of the most illuminating moments in the developing contradictions between the revolutionaries' republican idealism and their social reality. See, this is the issue. This is what Wood's saying. One of the things that became very clear that distinguished between the revolutionaries' republican idealism and their social reality came early in the Philadelphia Convention of 1787. On June 2nd, so if you want to look up Madison's notes, you can find this. On June 2nd, Benjamin Franklin proposed that members of the executive branch, the president and his appointees, quote, shall receive no salary, stipend, fee, or reward whatsoever for their services, unquote. That quote is directly out of Madison's notes. This was putting the issue about as starkly as it could be put, and the response of the convention tells us volumes about what was happening to the classical Republican tradition in America. The 81-year-old Franklin felt strongly about not paying people who served in government and had written out a speech which James Wilson delivered for him. The saving of money from the salaries was not his aim, he said. It was the evils that the salaries would cause that he wished to prevent. If the government paid salaries to its executive officials, it would attract into office the wrong sorts of men, the bold and the violent, the men of strong passions and indefatigable activity in their own selfish pursuits. By making our posts of honor places of profit, said Franklin, we would sow the seeds of contention, faction, and tumult. The old man realized that some may imagine that this is an utopian idea and that we can never find men to serve us in the executive department without paying them well for their services. But, he noted, the country gentlemen and the aristocrats of England and France took up burdensome offices without pay. And had not General Washington led the Continental Army for 8 years altogether without the smallest salary? These examples show that the pleasure of doing good and serving their country and the respect such conduct entitles them to are sufficient motives with some minds to give up a great portion of their time to the public without the mean inducement of pecuniary satisfaction. Surely America, he said, had sufficient numbers of such disinterested men. So Franklin is laying out before the Constitutional Convention, we better not pay these people because we're going to get the wrong kind of people. And, of course, you look at that quote from Emerson in 1830s, and Emerson saying, hell, Franklin was right on. Look what happened in our political system. Look at the people that are running. Look at the elections we won where we're giving alcohol to people in order to get them to vote a certain way. This has become a sham.
Well, could you find a way to contrast anything in any more of a dire situation? I mean, the contrast between what Franklin is saying and Jackson, Andrew Jackson, and embracing the spoil system, the idea that this is politics as it should be, that, you know, our people should come into office and all of those government jobs should go to our people, and everybody who supported our predecessors should go out. And that's the right way to do things.
And Gordon Wood says
it's all about jobs.
I think it's Empire of Freedom, but he says in one of his other books, Gordon Wood made the comment and said none of the founders ever dreamed that the typical American would be Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
They wanted the typical American to be George Washington, somebody who would serve for free, take no salary, blah, 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 would be the father of his country, etc. He was what the founders wanted Americans to copy. The Southern gentleman, the prestige, the well-educated, well-read, well-traveled,
right.
You know, an aficionado of the arts and music and literature and all that. And instead we end up with Andrew Jackson
as the
typical American. And so Andrew Jackson himself, what we think of when we think of Andrew Jackson, is a classic example of what Emerson is saying in that quote. And there's one other quote in the same chapter.
And while you're looking for it, if you think about the elections of 1824 and 1828, in some ways John Quincy Adams is kind of he's the last American president who does not like the idea of faction.
Right.
And does not want to identify with a party. Jackson embraces that completely.
He wants government to create the society that the founders believed would happen automatically.
And he is portrayed by the Jacksonians how? As an elitist.
As somebody that's out of touch with the
with people. European sensibilities and ideas.
And that's where we're going in the second course in the 19th century here, is we're going to pick it up with the end of the War of 1812, and we're going to look at the movement towards the election of Jackson and how this is symbolized by the split, the increasing split between North and South, et cetera, et cetera. This other quote is on page 295 of Wood's book, and he says, and I'm going to read this very fast, but he says, the want of learning and of science in the majority is one of those things which strikes foreigners who visit us forcibly. Our representatives to all our legislative bodies, national as well as of the states, are elected by the majority sui similis, that is, unlearned. For instance, from Philadelphia and its environs, we sent to Congress not one man of letters. One of them, indeed, is a lawyer, but of no eminence, another a good mathematician. But when elected, he was a clerk in a bank. The others are plain farmers. From the next county is sent a blacksmith. and from just over the river, a butcher. Our state legislature does not contain one individual of superior talents. The fact is that superior talents actually excite distrust, and the experience of the world perhaps does not encourage the people to trust men of genius. Remember the commercial, man of genius, Bud Light. This government of what may be called an unlettered majority has put down even that ideal rank which manners had established, excepting in our great cities depending on commerce and crowded with foreigners, where the distinction between what's called the gentleman and others still subsists and produces circles of association separate from each other. In Philadelphia, this is a letter written in 1806 during Jefferson's administration. In Philadelphia, even this distinction has almost disappeared. Those who expect it, having early excluded themselves from the present race of well-dressed men and women. Of this state of society, the solid and general advantages are undeniable. But to a cultivated mind, to a man of letters, to a lover of the arts, it presents a very unpleasant picture. The importance attached to wealth and the freedom which opens every legal avenue to wealth to everyone individually has two effects which are unfavorable to morals. It weakens the ties that bind individuals to each other by making all citizens rivals in the pursuit of riches, and it renders the means by which they are attained more indifferent. What he's talking about here is the emergence of what we call free enterprise capitalist society. We're talking about a society based on opportunity, people who are willing to seize opportunities, people who look towards the future, who look to get ahead, who seize the moment, who invest in the future, who salt it away for the future, who are willing to do whatever it takes now to benefit later on in the future. And it's an investment. Getting an education is investment in a more profitable future, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, all the things that the founders believe would tear the society apart begin to happen. And Emerson, in 1830, is looking back and saying, look what's happened to this society. We're falling apart. Everything we value is gone. And, of course, the epitome of this is the election of Jackson, who's everything that the founders would not want. And that's why I think Jackson, Emerson makes the comment, he says, not one of the founders died happy because of what the revolution had wrought. So that's the question. Look at, and again, if you go to Woody Holton's book on the 1780s and the Confederation period, and you look at the issue of investment and farms and taxes and paper money and all the rest of it, and you begin to look at the extent to which people's self-interest becomes predominant, you can begin to understand why the Madisons and the James Wilsons and the Dickinsons and the Hamiltons and the John Jays begin to say very early in the 1780s, hell, if we don't do something quick, independence is going to go down the tubes. Everything that was possible for us is going to be gone. And ultimately, what they suggest then is the idea that we better, if we can't do it on the state level, damn it, we better do it on the national level. And they begin to push towards the idea of creating a government which is strong enough so that the right people can control it.
I don't want to hold you up, because I know we need to get into a couple other questions. But this made me think of a quote from Washington, in which Washington talks about, and I can't remember the quote exactly, but you know how horrible it would be if we show that we cannot govern ourselves. How horrible it would be if we show that we cannot create the type of society that we claim that we could. In terms of how Britain would view us.
Right.
And what's going on in Britain at this time is essentially people in Britain who claim to know something about history and government and things of that nature are convinced the United States will fall apart, that they will not survive, because you had never had a successful republic, a representative government over such a large geographic space.
Right.
Their own sense of like Roman history, for example. Rome went from the Republic. The Republic died with Caesar, and you end up with the Principate. And so the idea being that this cannot work.
No.
It will not work.
And the belief, I mean, there's absolute shock when Washington voluntarily goes back to Mount Vernon
right.
and gives up power.
Yeah.
you know, in France, the gentry, the king of France, can't believe that he did this. Mm-hmm. He'll never do it. George III
said he must be the greatest man.
The greatest man yes. that ever lived, because nobody
right.
could do this.
Right, can't
give
happen.
Up power voluntarily, and that's ultimately the kind of people that this society, that mm-hmm. the founders believed the society had to be built around. And the question is how. And so my thesis would be, and again, I'm not suggesting my own thesis here, but there's no question in my mind that as I read Madison and Jefferson and the rest of them, the thinking of Madison and the others is what we need to do is create a national government that can make this happen, because the Confederation spirit is not, as long as power's in the states are screwing mm-hmm. all this up. The yeah. wrong people, the state governments are responding to the wrong interests and the wrong mm-hmm. people, and what we need to happen ain't happening. And what we need to do is shift power to the national level. Woody Holton says this in the first chapter of his book. The issue to understand the creation of the Constitution of the United States. What is it that caused people to willingly give up power to a stronger national government? And the answer he points out, and I wrote my dissertation on the same thing in Maryland. I said almost exactly the same thing that he says. And basically, my thesis was, and I wrote this in 1976, and my thesis was, in Maryland, the reason that the supporters of the Constitution supported it is because they wanted to take power to respond to the demands of the poor, of the people. People's demands that government responds to their needs. They knew that a government that responded to the needs of the people was doomed because the self-interest of the people would drive it into the ground. The argument is the only way you could deal with that politically was to take the power and put it somewhere else where the people couldn't get to it. And that ultimately becomes in Maryland at least, the rationalization for ratification of the Constitution. And the argument is that's what we're about. That's what we've got to do. So in a sense, if you want it to be cruel, if you want it to really be controversial, which is what Woody Holton is, you could say basically that the move from power being on the state level in the Confederation period to power being on the national level under the Constitution, the idea was to make sure that the right people kept power.
Just kind of off the top of my head, that really puts the Electoral College in a little bit of a different light, if you think about it. I mean, the whole idea of course, to some degree, I understand it's practical in the 18th century, but the idea that you want to insulate offices from the public to a degree,
right.
which is something that by the time that Emerson's writing is changing,
yeah.
right? I mean, suffrage was left at the states.
Right.
Even selection of electors was left up to the states. So, but by the time that we're dealing with what Emerson's writing, you have election of electors by the elector for the most part. You're dropping property qualifications. I don't believe it's an accident that the South is more reluctant to do that.
Right.
Especially Virginia and South Carolina. Yes, very much.
But, you know, one of the things that, as a political scientist, when I was teaching government, and this, you know, I don't know if anybody thinks about this. Political scientists don't, because they see the information as the end all, you know, I think.
They become more quantitative,
They become interested in the system itself. But if you look at the structure of government created by the Constitution, three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial. The legislative is composed of two parts, the House of Representatives and the Senate. If you look at the way each of these are appointed at the convention, and you look at Richard Beeman's treatment of the way that the convention happens and the structure of government that's created, the Senate is the members of the Senate are elected by the state legislatures, people are not given control. The Senate now is elected, but that happens in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
With an amendment to the Constitution. Up until the 20th century, senators were chosen by state legislatures.
17th Amendment, I believe.
What that means is that the most popular branch of government, which is the legislative branch, only one half of that branch the people are given direct input into.
Could be wrong.
The president is elected by the Electoral College, which is indirect election, and the Supreme Court is appointed by the president. So the people have no direct input into anything but one half of one of the three branches. And if you look at that, the distrust of the ability of the people to make intelligent decisions becomes eminently clear. And I think, so anyway, that I think is what the, I think
We could go on that one.
I'm sorry.
It's hard to resist not talking about some of the recent discussion about direct election of senators,
right.
And so we will resist it, right?
The second question will be easy.
Okay. All right, so you start here with a quote from Benjamin Rush, and I quote, "In our opposition to monarchy, we forgot that the temple of tyranny has two doors. We bolted one of them by proper restraints, but we left the other open, by neglecting to guard against the effects of our own ignorance and licentiousness." That's Benjamin Rush. Benjamin Rush wrote this in 1787 at a time when revision of the Articles was obviously on his mind, and many other minds as well. He seems to be telling us here why he is in favor of a revision of some sort. Do you agree with him? Imagine that you are Patrick Henry here. How would you respond to Rush's assessment of the nation's problems? This is the kind of question I like, because you're putting yourself into the past, putting yourself into the position of the historical figures, the kind of thing that, of course, teachers want to do with students.
Right. And it works. And, you know, and if you want to find out what Patrick Henry believes about the Constitution, read the chapters in Pauline Myers' book on Virginia ratification, and just look at the speeches by Patrick Henry. Look at the index in the back. Every page that Patrick Henry has mentioned is,
right.
You know, every page in this book. Just read the Patrick Henry sections, and you've got Patrick Henry on the Constitution, and now you'll know how he thought. Take that frame of mind and react to Benjamin Rush's quote. Mm-hmm. And Benjamin Rush said, we made a mistake. We bolted one door by building in restraints, but we forgot the other door, which is the effects of our own ignorance and licentiousness. In other words, what we didn't count on was that people will naturally go after what's best for them, their own self-interest. They won't put public interest first. They won't consider civic virtue first unless they're forced to. And what they were able to do is get control of the state governments. And the state governments are enacting laws which violate everything. They're going to drive this society down into the dust, is what they believe. So that's where Rush is coming from. We built in restraints, checks and balances and all that stuff, but we didn't, at the state level, count on the fact that if people got control of the government, they would turn government into an agent of their own self-interest. And their self-interest is contrary to the public interest.
Mm-hmm. Let me say one thing about the use of sources here for your question. If you use Pauline Myers' book to help answer this question, that book will lead you to the letters and to the documents in which she obtained that. If you can't find those documents, there's nothing wrong with taking Patrick Henry quoted in that book and saying, Patrick Henry quoted in Meyer. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all.
And that's what I thought you could go to Rotunda for. Hopefully it'll be available, but it may not be. So it'd be available if you go to campus, but it's not available now. But that's the second question. It's pretty straightforward. And I'm basically saying, do you agree with Rush or don't you? And imagine that you are Patrick Henry. How would Patrick Henry respond to Rush's concern about guarding against the effects of our own ignorance and our own licentiousness? Would Patrick Henry agree that it was ignorance and licentiousness that was producing... You know, I keep going back to the comment that John Kaminsky made to us last summer. And John Kaminsky said, you know, more and more I'm becoming convinced that some of the anti-federalists were right when they said that the Confederation could have worked. If they really wanted it to work, it could have worked. But given this thesis about where power is and who was going to have access to it, you had to get power out of the state level.
That struck me as well. And also his contention, essentially, the Confederation was not the miserable failure.
No.
That
John Fisk was picked up by, you know, that John Fisk wrote his book from the Madisons and the Hamiltons and all the rest of it, who wanted to argue that the society is going down the tube unless we do something. And thus we have question three, which is the long quote from Benjamin Franklin.
All right. Perhaps there is no better way to address the totality of the Constitutional Convention than to reflect upon the issues which threaten to divide the delegates and even at times break up the convention. With this theme in mind, let's focus for perspective on Benjamin Franklin's famous speech just before the convention adjourned. And a quote, "In these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults. if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us, and there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered, and believe farther that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years, and can only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it. When the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other, I doubt to whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. For when you assemble a number of men to have the advantages of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. From such an assembly can a perfect production be expected? It is therefore astonishes me, sir, to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think it will astonish our enemies, who are waiting with confidence to hear that our councils are confounded like those of the builders of Babel, and that our states are on the point of separation, only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. Thus I consent, sir, to this constitution, because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. The opinions I have had of its errors I sacrifice to the public good. I have never whispered a syllable of them abroad. Within these walls they were born, and here they shall die. If ever one of us, in returning to our constituents, were to report the objections he has had to it, and endeavor to gain partisans in support of them, we might prevent its being generally received, and thereby lose all salutary effects and great advantages resulting naturally in our favor among foreign nations, as well as among ourselves, from our real or apparent unanimity. Much of the strength and efficiency of any government in procuring and securing happiness to the people depends on opinion, on the general opinion of the goodness of the government, as well as of the wisdom and integrity of its governors. I hope, therefore, that for our own sakes, as a part of the people and for the sake of posterity, we shall act heartily and unanimously in recommending this Constitution, if approved by Congress and confirmed by the conventions. Wherever our influence may extend, and turn our future thoughts and endeavors to the means of having it well administered. On the whole, sir, I cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention, who may still have objections to it, would with me, on this occasion, doubt a little of his own infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument. There's the quote. The question, most people who even know about it view this speech as a prelude to the struggle over ratification that followed the adjournment of the convention. I wonder about looking at the speech instead as a way to explain much of the behavior that took place during the convention itself. As you consider the key issues, disagreements, strategies to attract support for a particular position, or to isolate one's opposition from support they might need, efforts to promote compromise, the give and take of negotiation, I'll support you on this if you support me on that, etc. All of the elements involved in politics of trying to get something as complex as the Constitution done. Does Franklin seem to capture here an attitude that you see as prevalent in the Philadelphia Convention? If yes, please examine the convention's events from this perspective. If not, then what seems to be the attitude which best exemplifies the convention, behavior, and results? Now, there's a note here as well. Besides Beeman's book, you know, Plain Honest Men, consider also Madison's notes and John Kaminsky's Federalists and Anti-Federalists. Kaminsky organized his sources around major segments of the Constitution: House of Representatives, Senate, Presidency, Judiciary, etc. Valuable insights here.
I think Franklin's quote is very plain. What Franklin is saying at the end of the convention, I always express it this way when I teaching, was, you know, kind of at the end, hey guys, look, you know, it ain't perfect. Every one of us would change something in here if we had a chance. But the fact of the matter is, while we've been open here and we've shared our disagreements and our and things we didn't like and all that, the fact of the matter is, this may be, given the mix of people that was here, this is a hell of a document. You know, look what we were able to do. So let's not nitpick and quibble about how to make it better, because if we go back to our states and we start building support for this part that we want to change or that part that we want to change, the whole thing will go apart. Let's all keep all of our criticisms to ourselves. Let's go back and tell our constituents, wherever we are, hey guys, This is the best damn thing that we ever came down the pike. The alternative, we're going down the tubes if we don't do it, and this has a darn good chance of working. We can amend it later. If we find out after we start that it's broken and parts of it don't work, we'll fix it. But let's pass it. And the only way to pass it is not to nitpick it and tear it apart, but go back and sell it as the best thing that we could ever do. Mm-hmm. Be a little bit, as he says, be a little bit sensitive to your own infallibility. In other words, don't go back and say what you think is the end-all, be it an end-all of everything. Be willing to accept the fact that maybe you're wrong. Maybe what you think is wrong with it is not right. And so his argument is, every time I've had a criticism of this thing, I defer it to public opinion. In other words, everybody else seems to think it's okay. Maybe I'm wrong. And his argument is, if everybody feels that way, and everybody is liable to interpret their concerns about certain parts of it, as if, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Everybody else seems comfortable with this. If everybody does that, we can get this through. Now, the question is critical, because the question, Franklin's quote, is about getting the Constitution ratified. But that's not the question that I've asked you here. The question that I've asked you is, to what extent does this sentiment of Franklin color the debates in the convention itself? Now, how would you do that? Well, for example, I can think of numerous examples. I can give you a few. But basically what it is, what you'd be looking for, are places where people disagree and say, the vote indicated that these people wanted this and those people wanted that. The result was a compromise where neither one got what they wanted, but each one got enough so they could say, I can live with that, and they go on to the next thing. In other words, to what extent is Franklin's sentiment here a way to understand the whole convention? Even though nobody got exactly what he wanted, the fact of the matter is, there was more holding them together than there was dividing them. In other words, to the point that they were really willing to give and take and make compromises. Now, there are numerous examples of that. Beeman talks about Madison's notes. Madison himself talks about he believed going in that you had to have a congressional veto over all state legislation. Now, you've seen that everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
What Madison believed, in order for the federal government to work under the Constitution, the federal government had to have the power to strike down as unconstitutional any law in any state that the federal government believed was contrary to the Constitution. That's what he meant by the right to veto all state legislation. Now, obviously, Madison doesn't get that. But as Beeman points out, he and Wilson hang on and hang on and hang on. They refuse to give it up, because Madison believes that if you don't have a veto on the federal level of state law, if you allow the states to maintain any of their independence, this can't work. So Madison is very reluctant to give up the congressional veto. Finally, it's replaced by the Supremacy Clause, where and the irony, I don't know if anybody picked this up or not, but Luther Martin of Maryland, who's one of the leading opponents of the Constitution, leaders of the Anti-Federalists, Luther Martin is the one who proposes the Supremacy Clause, that the Constitution will be the supreme law of the land, because he sees the alternative as being Madison's congressional veto, and he doesn't want that, because that's the end of state power. That's a total destruction of state power. So Luther Martin's belief is, if we get the idea that federal, the laws of Congress and all the laws made under the Constitution will be the supreme law of the land, then basically what he's saying is that, all things being equal, federal law will take precedence over state law, but you don't give the federal government the right to strike down state law. You don't give them that much power. The state powers will be gone. So Luther Martin sees the Supremacy Clause as a compromise he has to make. It's not what he wants. He wants the Confederation. But he sees what Madison wants as a possibility, and rather than have that, he's willing to accept the supremacy. The other thing that comes out of it is the judicial review. That ultimately it's going to be the Supreme Court that's going to decide what the supreme law of the land is. And that ultimately the legality of certain laws, state and federal, is going to be decided by the Supreme Court. The irony of the situation is, if you read Hamilton's Federalist, I think it's 37, but I'm not sure, maybe 78, But Hamilton writes a Federalist paper, and basically he lays out, everybody says that judicial review begins with Marbury versus Madison. Hamilton laid it out in one of the Federalist papers. Yeah. They knew that courts tell you what the law is. They knew going in that the Supreme Court would ultimately define what's constitutional and what's not constitutional. Mm-hmm. So, but that kind of, that's what I'm looking for. Those kinds of compromises where nobody gets what they want, but everybody realizes that I'll take a little bit because it's more important than we stay here. And when you get to the point where the convention almost is willing to split over slavery.
Three-fifths compromise.
Yes, yeah. Three-fifths, the slavery issue. Yeah. The South is threatening to walk out. And the Madisons and the rest of them, and the Nationalists, Hamilton and the rest of them, have to make concessions to the South, because if the South walks out over slavery,
It's over. Yeah.
It's over. And so all the compromises that we study about leading up to the Civil War are just further examples of something that happens in the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. The first major compromises are made in Philadelphia in 1787. So that's what I'm asking. Apply Benjamin Franklin's thinking to the convention and the stories here in Beeman, along with Madison's notes and the rest of it.
This quote really also highlights that element of secrecy in terms of the convention proceedings itself.
Right.
Because he addresses that and talks about that specifically, and essentially wants to maintain that, obviously, beyond the closing of the convention. So, I haven't said anything publicly outside of these walls about any objections that I have had. I mean, he certainly Benjamin Franklin is a character who plays characters. He plays roles. And he is playing here the elder statesman.
Well, elder statesman is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is, hey, guys, the people outside this convention, they're only going to know what we tell them. Here's what we need to tell
him. And some of those elements are foreign nations. So he's concerned about the status of the new nation in the world and several other things. Great quote. We have like 20 minutes.
Well,
so you want to go ahead and go to this next question?
Let's go to the one on ratification. This is a neat one.
Okay. On ratification, Benjamin Randall, a delegate from the town of Sharon to the ratifying convention in Massachusetts, tried his best to counter the fact that the state's very best speakers and most prestigious people had united behind the new Constitution. His strategy? To make the simple point that a good thing don't need praising. That's a quote. A good thing don't need praising.
That's right out of Pauline Myers' book.
Okay. So Randall is but one small example of what opponents to the Constitution faced in trying to stop a movement from ratification that seemed to have all the momentum it needed to be successful. Despite history's suggestion to the contrary, ratification was not a done deal. Until the very end of the process, at least until New York voted yes in late July 1788, even then New York's vote, by the slimmest margin of 30-27, was muddied by a circular letter to the other states requesting that another convention be called to consider amendments. 46 delegates at the New York convention signed the letter. As you look at ratification in some of the key states, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, New York, Virginia, even Rhode Island, which refused to ratify, how would you tell to your students this story? Are those folks correct who believe that ratification was destined because the Constitution itself was divinely inspired? Is this a story of simple political manipulation and intrigue, nothing more? Is it principally a story about how the framers tricked the American people into approving something they didn't really understand? Is it a story about the framers, or is it really a story about the ignorance of people? Is it but more evidence to show that people really don't know what's best for them? The ends justify the means. Note, what from this story might you use to create interest among your students in the topic? Do Sam Adams and John Hancock retain the patriot image they earned in the mid-1770s once we examine their behavior a decade later? Patrick Henry, more of a hero than you thought, or less?
The issue there is the story of ratification. And without beating a dead horse, there's no question that people believe, and we're told all the time by the Glenn Becks and the O'Reillys and all the rest of it, we are told that, that the founders created the Constitution, it was ratified, we had this new government with, Washington as president. And the implication is that this was a near unanimous thing. Well, it's obvious from the size of Pauline Myers' book, and she only deals with 8 states of the 13 here, that ultimately ratification was a struggle. And it was not a done deal. And it was very close. And I use this example as to how close it was from New York, because I think the 30-27 final vote to ratify in New York, given the fact that New York was the last big state. I mean, it was the, without New York, even though, you know, New Hampshire was the 9th state. So even though 9 states had ratified, if you didn't get Virginia and New York, it wasn't going to fly. Yeah. So Virginia ratifies in late June. And then you go to New York. And New York ratifies by 30-27. You know, and then one of the strategies, by this time, one of the strategies of the anti-federalists, excuse me, is to get a second convention. Their argument is they're not giving us time to organize. We're not going to be able to defeat ratification state by state. Well, the only chance we got is to get them back into a second convention where we begin to discuss amendments. And once we get everybody in the same room, we'll make the changes we really need to make. And we'll get rid of this Constitution thing, and we'll get back to the Confederation. We'll make the changes in the Confederation that need to be made, and we'll go on. You know, so the Madisons and the Hamiltons and the Jays and the rest of them are petrified about the Second Convention, the last thing they want. And for proof of that, Franklin's quote that Keith just read. Franklin says in the thing, you know, we have all these people. It's a wonder to God we got what we got. The last thing they want is another convention. So the anti-federalists know that they can create the call for a second convention. I think it's significant that New York ratifies, you know, after the fact. You already have 9th state. Virginia's the 10th. New York is the 11th state to ratify. You only need 9. Even though it's the 11th state, it only ratifies 30-27. But then the convention agrees on a circular letter calling for a convention to consider amendments. And 46 delegates. Now remember, only 30 have voted to ratify. 46 of them vote to sign the letter. So even though 30 people voted to ratify in New York, a number of those want a second convention. Yeah. So this is not, by any means, this is not a done deal. And the point I'm trying to make is she tells the story in state after state. I'm not gonna tell you. I want to tell you enough to tease you if you haven't had a chance to read this yet. In Pennsylvania, the convention adjourns, and they decide we might as well start right here because the Pennsylvania legislature is meeting in this building. We're upstairs in Constitutional Hall. Downstairs, the Pennsylvania legislature is convening. Is meeting. Let's take this Constitution that we just adopted and let's go downstairs with the damn thing and get Pennsylvania legislature to ratify it. So they bring it downstairs to the Pennsylvania legislature, and several of the members of the Pennsylvania legislature are in the convention, James Wilson, you know, being one. And the minute the members of the Pennsylvania legislature get a look at the thing, now their thinking is that they're upstairs ratifying the Articles of Confederation. Down comes this whole new government. So the members of the legislature take do what politicians all do. I move, we adjourn, I second, and they take off. Right? So then the only way that the members, that the nationalists, the supporters of the Constitution, can get Pennsylvania to ratify is to go out and round up members of the Pennsylvania legislature until they have enough of them to form a quorum. So they go to the bars and the taverns and the halfway houses throughout Philadelphia, and they physically drag members of the legislature back to the convention hall until they have enough to get a vote. They declare a quorum, and they ratify the Constitution. You know, they don't ratify the Constitution. They call the convention to ratify the
ratification.
And if what's going on in Wisconsin right now with the members of the Democratic members of the legislature of Wisconsin fleeing to Illinois to so there won't be a quorum, so this vote cannot happen on taking away union rights, collective bargaining rights of public employees in the state of Wisconsin. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they did exactly the same thing. So if you can't get your students in interested in ratification in Pennsylvania when you read the stories of them dragging half-drunk people back to the convention just so that we have enough people there to declare a quorum and call a convention and call a special election for a convention. Then you go to Massachusetts. The majority of the people elected to the convention are anti-federalists. They run for election saying, if I'm elected, I'm going to vote against this damn thing. And the majority of the people elected to the convention. So the nationalists, the Fisher Ames and the rest of the federalists, are saying, we got to do something here. We're going to get a negative vote. If we take the vote right now, the Constitution loses in Massachusetts, one of the biggest states. What are we going to do? So the argument is, we got to figure out how to get some of these people who are committed to voting against it to vote for it. How do we do that? Well, one thing they begin to play with is amendments. Maybe we can promise amendments.
Right.
The other thing they do is they look and they say, who are the heroes in Massachusetts? John Hancock and Sam Adams.
Yeah.
If we can get those guys to speak in favor of the Constitution, we might be able to squeeze through a positive vote. Sam Adams is lieutenant governor. He's opposed to the Constitution, but for reasons which aren't quite clear, he's willing to support it. Draw your own conclusions. Hancock is the key, because Hancock is the governor, but he's sick with the gout. Hancock, throughout his political career, always has attacks of the gout when it's convenient to not be at work. So they go to Hamilton and they to Hancock, and they visit him at home. And it's all laid out there. Henry Knox and the rest of them explain, this is the way they deal with it. They go to Hancock and they say, John, everybody knows that Washington's going to be president if this thing passes. It's pretty obvious with a Virginian as president that the vice president has to be in New England. If you can swing votes for us, if you can help us get this through, we'll make sure that you're that person. You will be the vice president of the United States. And they point out, Washington is sending out all these letters saying he doesn't want to go. He's back in private life. He doesn't want to come back into public life anymore. It's not clear that Washington will even be willing to be president, in which case you could be the president of the United States. They play to Hamilton's, to Hancock's vanity. Hancock goes into the convention, gives a speech to the Massachusetts Ratified Convention, urges them to give it a chance. And they use Hancock's vanity and all the rest of it to get it through. Then you go to Virginia, and that's where you have the Madison Patrick Henry duel, and you got to deal with Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry's brilliant; takes two chapters. John Kaminsky's project has three volumes on Virginia, five volumes on New York. By the time you collect all the documents. So they go through all this thing about Patrick Henry and getting Patrick Henry. Read what Patrick Henry, some of the speeches he gives, and how effective and how persuasive he is and all this. How are they going to get this through? Finally, Madison has to become an advocate for a Bill of Rights, because if they don't agree to put a Bill of Rights on, it ain't going to pass. So, again, I go back to repeat something that I said before, but I think it's fascinating. Most people today believe the Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights are synonymous. I mean, the Constitution is the Bill of Rights to most people. There wasn't even a Bill of Rights in it. When the founders didn't believe it was necessary. The only reason that they agreed to add a Bill of Rights is to get the Constitution ratified. And then Madison has to play with the rights to make sure that the rights that they are willing to put in the Bill of Rights don't affect anything related to federal power. In other words, Madison separates the amendments that will do harm to the power of the federal government versus the amendments that they don't really care about, like freedom of the press and religious freedom and freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and the right to bear arms and all this stuff that aren't even issues. The real issue is the power of the federal government versus the power of the states. And Madison wants to make sure that none of those amendments sneak in. And that's the way you get the Bill of Rights ratified. So I guess the point I'm trying to make, and the reason I think this is a good question for you as teachers, if you can't get kids interested in the stories that are going on with these, and some of the quotes that she cites, she gives you the dates of the letters, you got the whole thing available on Rotunda, it's a fantastic story.
You say here in the question, at the very end of the question, about Hancock and Henry She had Sam Adams and John Hancock retain the Patriot image they earned in the mid-1770s. You talk about Patrick Henry, is he more of a hero than you thought or less? To what degree do you believe this is really a matter of the fact that the winners, in essence, have been able to write the story, that they've dominated the story? And part of that may have to do with their talent as writers. Patrick Henry is a great orator, but he doesn't translate well into the written form, onto the page.
And I put Mercy Otis Warren's observations on the Constitution on Blackboard. It's 11 pages long. It's tough reading. And
thank you. 5 minutes, okay.
5 minutes. We're keeping time. We're not going to keep you over. And I put Mercy Otis Warren's observations on the Constitution. And she lists, if you look at it, it's 11 pages, it's intimidating. But look at the numbers, and what you have is 19 pieces of information she has in criticism of the Constitution. And basically, if you can cut through the rhetoric, and that's one of the anti-federalist problems, they get carried away with their own, it's all flowery language and stuff, that they really never get down to the nitty-gritty of doing political business. The Federalists are ruthless. They are determined to get this thing through. The anti-federalists, I believe, are not as organized, as well organized, and as committed. They're committed to defeating the Constitution, but not to, they're still orators. You know what I mean? They still consider themselves to be more orators than they are than they do politicians. It seems to me that where I got that last, those last comments on that last question about Sam Adams and John Hancock and Patrick Henry is from the story of independence, Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, and the role that Sam Adams played and the role that John Hancock's played in independence and the Boston Tea Party and all the rest of it. They're heroes of independence. They are people who risk their own lives to lead the movement for independence. They're exactly what the founders in 1776 believed the leaders of an independent nation had to be. They're people willing to put the best interests of the people ahead of their own self-interest. But then you look at them at the time of the Constitution, and the Federalists are able to play to their own vanity and their own self-interest and their own ego and able to get from them what they want. So in a sense, Sam Adams and John Hancock, at least this is when I was writing the question, it occurred to me, maybe what we're seeing is Sam Adams and John Hancock becoming exactly what Emerson said the whole country was becoming, was more than willing to sell out if the price was right. Mm. And I don't know that that's true, because that implies that you're opposed to free enterprise development. But there's no question that a nation with the available land in the West and all the rest of it, a mobile society with new immigrants coming in from Europe all the time and moving west, and the availability of land and the availability of opportunity and all the rest of it, there was so much working against the value system of the founders as it existed in 1776. There was no way that the ideals of the founders could happen in real life. And the Confederation period kind of is the test. It's taking, it's taking the ideals and the values of the founder and putting wheels on them and see how they really work.
Does that explain the perceived difference between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution?
Jensen argues.
Okay.
Merrill Jensen argues that the Constitution of the United States is nothing else but a counter-revolution. It's an effort to undo the Revolution of 1776. Because the founders believed that they were seeing the worst aspects of what independence was going to produce. As long as the mother country was there, as long as Mother England was there, there was stability. There was at least the illusion of stability. If things got out of hand, if the people got too uppity and all the rest of it, there were always British troops could come over and crush it. Once you create the Confederation with no strong central government, there's no order beyond state order. And with the majorities of the people participating in government and owning land and able to vote and able to put pressure on their representatives, you had a situation where you were coming very, very close to this idea of the majority of the people making decisions for government, forcing government to be responsible to them rather than to the elite who had traditionally run things. And so Jensen would argue that the Constitution of the United States was an effective counter-revolution. And, you know, I didn't mention a whole lot about Woody Holton's book in the 1780s, but the stories there about investments and about investments in securities and all the rest of it, fantastic stuff.
Well, I think our time has elapsed. I think our time has elapsed.
We're out of time. I'm just warning them. Hey, y'all, listen, if you have any questions or you need any help, if there's anything we can do to help you, aim for April 1st on this, and I'll do the best I can to start returning these essays to you via email. Not physically the essays. I can have Margaret mail them to you, but I'm going to send you an email and make a comment about your essay and tell you what your grade is and all. Keith, anything else?
No, I just appreciate everybody participating with us in the program generally.
We will be in touch with you. If you need us, call us. I mean it. Email us, call us, whatever you need to do. mramseyconcord.edu. Thank you so much. I hope a great evening. Be safe and enjoy.